Rose. We're ready to go ahead and get started.
Okay. I will transfer the lines into the main call. Once the music stops, you're able to go ahead because I understand that there's no introduction for me, correct?
That's correct.
And this process could take up to 30 seconds. One moment, please.
Okay, welcome everyone. My name's Tom Wallace, and I'm the Bureau Chief of Medicaid Program Finance. I'll be facilitating today's Nursing Home Prospective Payment System public meeting. Looks like a lot of you have been with us through this whole series of public meetings we've been having. This is the fifth public meeting we've had, We've had six Governor's Committee meetings. And so with the public meeting, I'd like to just make everyone aware that this is being recorded. A copy of today's recording will be placed on our website, as we've done historically with the other public meetings, so anyone can always go back there and listen to what we have to say. All conference lines will be operator assistant today. The operator will unmute the line when we're ready to take public comments from the folks on the phone, and I'll notify the operator of that. For those of you on the phone that would like to have a copy of today's meeting materials, if you have not found them, they're in the same location we have always put them on. It's on our website. And I'll just go through this quickly here again, but you can find them on the ACA website at aca.myflorida.com. Then click on the hyperlink titled Medicaid. Then go ahead and scroll down the table and you'll see a page with another hyperlink that's titled Nursing Home Prospective Payment System. You should then see a copy of today's agenda and the slideshow out there. In addition to the meeting materials, you can find the webinar out there as well, so you can follow along as we go through the slides today. Just click on that webinar link. Also, just let everyone know that if it's time and you'd like to make public comment or have questions, as always, if you could please use a microphone. We'll have a couple people that goes around the room and hand that out, and you just state your name and the organization you're with. I would appreciate that. We'll take the questions and public comment from these folks in the audience first, and then we will go to those on the line. So today, just a couple opening comments here. This is the fifth public meeting. We've listened to a lot of stakeholder input at the public meetings as well as individual stakeholder meetings that we've had. So today what you'll see is kind of where we stand at this point. There'll be a couple models that are presented, and this is, you know, where we are by taking all the feedback from you guys out there. So we'll walk through those simulations today. We still would welcome feedback, but we're running out of time here, so we'd like to have feedback as quickly as possible. Again, if feedback today in public meeting, provide that to us. Also, feel free to provide us written feedback if you like to, of the whole process or of what you see today, of these simulations. I would like to have that back to us, though, by end of day tomorrow, if possible, so we can move forward. As everyone knows, we have a report that's due to the legislature January 1st, so we're getting close to the time. Also like that feedback so we can maybe meet one more time internally with our governance committee process and kind of talk about whatever came out of this meeting with that group, so that would be helpful. So with that and having opened up that way, I think it's time we can go ahead and turn it over to Navigant, and Jay will start us off going through the presentation we have today.
Thank you, Tom. So I'm going to go over the quality measures and that component of the model. Mal's going to talk about the latest pricing models, the transition period, and a summary of policy decisions. So there's not a lot new from the last time we made a presentation. We made a few changes to the quality model, and I'll go into those in a little bit. We had some questions over in the last meetings about how the weighting worked within the quality portion of the model. And this is just an example. It's one of the models we looked at, and we just pulled the top 10 of the providers with the highest quality scores. It just kind of illustrate how the points and the weighting works. So you can see that, and I'm going to just kind of point out the folks with a quality score of 25, 24, 23, that you can see that for the same points, there's the same per diem value attached to that point. So folks with in this model with a quality score of 25 had a $28.97 add-on. Each point has a dollar value attached to it, and depending on the model you look at, depending on the variable, you adjust that dollar amount changes, but it changes consistently throughout the model. The slide here, for those of you who are technically inclined, is the formulas that we use to help develop the quality pricing model. The recommendations that we have so far, the quality incentive pool is still 7% of the non-property component of the funds. It's funded with the nursing home assessment, excess funds first, and then the remainder comes from the direct, indirect, and operating components. Still undecided. We're looking at various iterations between here. The 30th percentile as a cutoff for a floor to qualify for the quality incentive payments. No floor, which would mean anybody with some quality points, either through a percent improvement or through meeting some of the measures that we'll discuss in a little bit, would qualify for a portion of the funding, or somewhere in between. And as Tom mentioned, that if you have some suggestions or recommendations on that, please submit that either during a public comment or in writing. And then I'm going to show you the quality model as it exists. Nothing's changed on this first slide. The point distribution, the percent improvement, all this remains the same. It's been pretty consistent for the last couple public hearings. The major changes occur on the second slide, and the model gets slightly longer. You'll see that we right now have the combined direct care staffing separated from the social work activity staffing. Part of the reason behind that is right now they come from two separate reports, and to ensure that they were consistent, we divided that up between those two different reports and 3 points, but it still equals the 6 points as it did in an earlier model. You'll also see under other credentials, we moved the Florida Gold Seal, still under the structural measures, Florida Gold Seal, and we added the Joint Commission Accreditation for Nursing Facilities and the American Healthcare Association National Quality Award silver or gold levels for consideration for receiving those points. So having one of these would allow you to earn the 5 points for that component. Some of you saw an earlier model where it was broken into three separate portions and points attached to each one of them. We felt like for an equitability and that we didn't want providers to feel as if they had to pursue every quality model that was out there in order to qualify for the full point. So this is an OR calculator. So if you have one of these, you would qualify for the full 5 points, but it's not additive. So you wouldn't get 15 points if you happen to have all three. And the model still equates to about 40 points or 240 points total. I want to skip real quick because we're going to show you throughout this two different simulations. The first one is the model that has the no floor to the threshold, no threshold in order to qualify for the quality points. And you can see the range and payments for the quality incentive add-ons, 52 cents for the lowest to $35.70 to the highest. Model 36 has the 30% floor that we talked about in the previous meeting. $13.81 is the minimum quality payment, and the max is right now $41.71. Make sure I'm on the right slide here. So this is just a graphical representation of what the quality score looks like by facility. Now, remember, model simulation 35 is no floor, so you can see that 12 facilities get between $0 and $4, and one facility gets upwards of $35, $36, and you saw the range earlier, with a decent distribution right there in the middle, as we kind of seen in some other our presentations. Model 36 does have the 30 percentile floor, so in order to qualify, your quality score has to be at least at the 30th percentile. The 30th percentile in this model right now is right around 10.5 points in order to qualify. So you'll see there's nobody who receives less than 11 points. And then the distribution is skewed to the right because we do have that cutoff of the lower performing on our quality measures, not receiving anything. And here is our quality per diem and the increase by facility. And again, this is the make sure I'm on the right slide. Yes. So this is the per diem that facilities would receive. Again, remember on that first table where I showed you different distributions, but the 30 percentile floor, your quality payments become much larger because not everybody's getting a piece of it. It's limited to only those who are scoring in the highest 70%, basically. And again, your highest payments increase because, again, not everybody's getting a portion of it, so it's divided. The same pool is divided among a fewer number of providers who qualify. And you want to open up for questions now, or?
All right, so this quality section we've gone through that Jay's went through, are there any questions on that so far? There's a couple hands here. We've got some mics going around.
Dale York from 1199. On slide 8. The staffing, wasn't that in a previous maximum of 5 points per facility? It says 3. Is that a typo?
So it's 3 for each category, which if you in the earlier model you saw both of those added together when we were unsure how the where the data comes from. So it's still a maximum of 6 for both of those combined.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Next question for go to Irwin up here.
Thank you. Could you please go through the weighted quality score a little bit? I'm somewhat puzzled how a particular unweighted score is going to get the exact same amount when you end up weighing it with Medicaid days. When you look at the per diems, I think on slide 2, you're indicating that there's a weighing process for the quality.
Right. So basically what we're doing is we're multiplying the quality scores for each provider times the number of Medicaid days, and then we're dividing that by the total number of Medicaid days to come up with a total weighted score. Then we're dividing each provider's score by the sum of the weighted scores, and then we convert that to a per diem amount. So at the end of the day, everybody, if you have two facilities that have a quality score of 24, they would get the exact same per diem amount.
Thank you.
Hi, Lauren Simmons with Moore Stevens Lovelace. I just want to go back real quick to that methodology 2 slide where you explained the maximum number of points as being 3. I just want to clarify that that's a typo and you're going to have a 1, 2, and 3-point category as opposed to the 1, 3, and 5. Is that where the error is?
Could be. Let's look.
Oh, I see. It's a bit. It's a bit.
Okay, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. That's a typo. It should be for the...
Sorry, that is a typo on the first portion of those slides.
So it should be 1, 2,
be
and 3
one, two,
across,
three. Yes.
Across top. Okay, thank you. Just one more question. On the summary of quality per diem add-ons, the last slide, where you've got the 30 percentile floor, how is it possible that you have zero number of facilities on the far left there? Is this just the population of those facilities that will get something and it's not the full?
This is actually the per diem and not their quality score that's being shown on this particular slide.
So this is just for the population of facilities that will get at least the minimum?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you.
Any other questions here in the room? Okay. So, operator, let's go ahead and see if there's any questions on the phone, please.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask an audio question, please press star 1. Your first question comes from the line of Maria Rivera. Please proceed.
This is John Hain. I'm the executive director of Florida Presbyterian Homes. In your quality add-ons, in the situation of the Gold Seal, of Jayco, and of the American Healthcare Silver, we learn from each time that we do one of those. We learn something from Gold Seal. We learn something more from the Silver. And when we get to the point of applying for Jayco, we really expect to learn some more from Jayco. Rather than limiting the award to 5 points, it would seem that you would want a system that would motivate organizations to move towards each one of those and continue to try to get better all the time. That's all.
Okay. I will just say for the record and for the audience here, each one of the credentials that we referenced above do have to continuously be earned. They're not given. So in order to retain that credential, you have to continuously improve and reapply. And for Jayco, their site visits for the ACA Baldrige related award, there are also requirements that if you don't pursue the higher level, the gold award, you would no longer retain your silver level. So there are incentives built into the each one of these credentials that kind of requires participating facilities to continuously seek improvement, which we feel all of them that we're looking at, and including have an evidence base behind them that will result in better performance in a lot of the measures that we're building into the model anyway. So they'll have a kind of a double impact on the overall performance of the facility.
Were there any other questions on the phone?
There are no remaining questions.
Okay, thank you. All right, so with that, I think, Mal, you'll go ahead and move forward on the latest pricing models.
Thanks, Tom. Good afternoon, everyone. We have two models that we're going to go through today. As Jay mentioned, we're still kind of debating on what is the appropriate percentile or threshold to use for applying quality incentive payments. So the two models that we're showing here today, the only difference they have is that they have the first one has no threshold, so anyone with non-zero points for quality is going to get some money through the quality incentive program. The second one, which is our number 36, has this 30th percentile, which we had shown in some models in the past, which says that for quality, you have to at least your score, you know, under the scoring method Jay just went through, your score has to be at the 30th percentile for all the facilities in Florida or above to qualify to get any of the quality money. So those are the only two differences between the two simulations we're going to go through. There are a couple of changes that both simulations have included in them that are different from what was in the last meeting we had a month ago. So we want to at least go through that. On the FRVS side, we have changed our calculation for total square footage to be patient square footage times 1.6, which works out to be about the average square footage for what we've calculated. Sorry for those on the phone. We had a little trouble with the microphone, so we just switched it out. Thank you. So we're using this kind of a standardized number of 1.6, which is about 37% of total square footage for a facility being for non-patient care. The 37% comes out to be right in the middle, pretty close to the average, and we'll show you some numbers in a minute, but pretty close to the average of what the facilities have across the state. And we'll talk about that a little bit more when we get to that next slide. And then this next point is maybe a minor point, but I just wanted to highlight that in case you go back, those who have gotten our models and have checked some of the numbers, there actually was a mistake in the way we were calculating square footage in the models that were presented in the last public meeting. We weren't grabbing total square footage for all facilities when we intended to. For some facilities, we were getting their patient care when that's not what we intended to do. So just for those who really dig into the numbers, and if it looks like things aren't adding up to what we presented before, that might be why. Then we've made some small changes to the parameters in the FRVS. We'll go through that towards the end of the presentation, but nothing too outrageously significant in there. The next thing that's in the models that's new from last month is that we are using now inflated costs I think that was a very good suggestion. What that has meant is that our total average cost or median cost is higher now that we've inflated everyone up to the current, up to the new year or the rate year. As a result, we've had to lower the percent of the median that we're taking because the median is now higher. And obviously, we have to stay budget neutral. So that's kind of the way it plays out in the numbers. And I'll show that in some detail in a minute. Okay, so talking a little bit more about the square footage, we had some debates going back and forth about what to do with home office costs. If you remember, we had moved home office cost into operating component in the models that we presented last month. We did kind of like that as an option, but it is admittedly, it does take the home office costs and sort of spread it across every facility, even a facility that doesn't have a home office cost, because we just lump those costs into the operating component.
Hey, Mel, just to clarify, too, when we're talking about home office costs, we're talking about home office property-related costs, not total home office costs.
Thank you. So then there were some other suggestions given, and then we thought we could look at this next chart. We looked at what the data we have, which is not 100% complete, but we have probably 500 facilities. We have what is their total square footage and what is their patient square footage. So for those facilities, we were able to look at what's the average amount of their square footage in their facility that is not patient care related. And again, the averages came out to between about 36 and 40. And we said, well, we can simplify this a little bit if we just take an average and say that's what we're going to use for every facility as their space or square footage that is non-patient care related. And then we can apply that to calculate a total square footage. And that can go straight into the FRVS component and calculate an FRVS payment. So this is what is included in these models. And so as part of that, what we also did, of course, is take those home office property costs. It was about $9 million. Took them back out of operating and put them back into the property or FRVS component. I think we've already talked about what's the difference between these two simulations. And again, it's just the distribution of the quality payments, if you will. So now we're going to go through some of the details on the two simulations. These charts will hopefully start to look familiar. You've seen them for a couple of months now. As you'll see, our percent of median for direct care is now 100% of the median. I'm pretty sure in our last models it was at 110%. So this is an example where the fact that we've included inflation and our medians are now higher, we've had to take a smaller percentage of the median. But we still went with the basic premise or concept that we want the direct care percentage of median that we take to be the highest, indirect somewhere in the middle, and operating percentage of the median to be the lowest. So we stayed consistent with that. And we have stayed consistent with the 95% floor for direct care and indirect care and no floor in operating. So that's consistent from last month. We have kept in a $200 a day ventilator care add-on payment. It happens to add up to about $8.2 million. We heard from one stakeholder this week that this is, well, let me state first, this is not new money. Our direction is very clear to be budget neutral. So this add-on payment has to come out of the payments for other existing components. And we heard from one stakeholder that if it's not going to be new money, we'd really rather not have this extra ventilator care. I think in our mind, we thought this was helpful to the industry, and if there seems to be consensus that it's not helpful to the industry, I don't see any reason not to take it out. But anyway, we'd be interested. That's, let's say, still another one of the items that's open for debate. We'd be interested in your feedback if you'd like. Next slide starts to show in summary form the increases and decreases in payment by facility. As we talked about in the last meeting, this new payment method is a big enough change from a facility-specific method that it's quite a challenge to try to limit the number of increases and decreases. We continue to try to do that, but we're not going to get to zero. There are going to be some increases and decreases with this. This particular chart is by facility. and kind of gives a quick estimate or a quick summary of how it has played out under this model, not significantly different than the previous models from September or October, I guess. Tom probably already said this, but we are planning to put out some spreadsheets on the ACA website probably by end of day tomorrow that will have the numbers individually by facility, so you can look at it as well in more detail than just this chart. The next one summarizes it by corporation. And again, we've mentioned this, but we try to continue to mention it, that if we identify what corporation a facility is part of by their home office, the name of the home office that they submit on their cost report. And there are a large number of facilities, about 168, I think, is the number, that do not report a home office, in which case we group them all together into one category called independent. So we have an independent corporation, if you will. Anyway, this just tries to summarize by increases and decreases by corporation. The next one, we start to get into more detail. I'm sure most people would like to see, you know, detail by facility. Well, there's 600 facilities, so we can't easily get that on a presentation. So we just try to highlight the top and bottom of the list, in all honesty, and then, of course, we'll give the full list out so folks can look at it in detail. But this does prove the point. This one is by corporation on slide 20. Does prove the point that there are some increases and decreases. And again, independent, that is our grouping of the individual facilities. For those folks, that number isn't very helpful. You'll obviously have to go look at your individual numbers when you get a chance to see them. Similarly, we do two charts by facility just to try to highlight the top and the bottom of the list. This one is sorted by dollar amount. The next one is sorted by percentage. We do that quite simply because if you're a small facility, your percentage change may be high, but your actual dollar amount may be low in comparison to larger facilities, so you simply won't show up on one that's sorted by dollar amount. But anyway, this is the top 15 increases and decreases by dollars, and then quickly we have it by percentage as well. Again, we want to limit the winners and losers to the extent that we can, while at the same time creating a payment method that we think is valid and defensible and creates the type of incentives that we're hoping to create, quality of care in particular. So actually, one of the things we'll see in the next grouping, this simulation 36, is that it does have a little bit less increases and decreases by facility. So from that point of view, it's slightly better. And in addition, ideally what we'd like to do is, if we're going to have a payment increase, we'd like it in theory to be for a facility that's providing high quality care to the extent that we can, which gets into our debate of whether our percentile for quality payments be at 0 or at 30 or some other number. Anyway, this is simulation 36. We'll go through some of the same numbers. For 36, this slide of direct, indirect, and operating is identical to 35 because we made no changes in this area of the calculations. And then we start to look at the differences by facility. Again, if you compare these two charts for the two simulations, you'll see that it's a little taller in the middle. It's not significantly different, but a little taller in the middle on simulation 36. And we'd hope that, again, that this, for those who are gaining, that to the extent that we can, we hope those are the facilities that have high quality, and using that higher percentile in the distribution of the quality incentive helps with that a bit. So I'll go quickly through the next few by corporation. I know I'm sure you're going to be more interested in getting to the spreadsheet than going through these charts here. So anyway, we do have it by corporation, by facility, and then listing the top 15 high and low. All right. If you don't mind, Tom, could we open it up for questions here?
Okay, if there are any questions in the room on this section we just went through, feel free to ask them now. Are there any? Okay, not seeing any in the room right now. Operator, you want to check on the phone, see if there's any questions on the section we just covered?
Absolutely. If you have an audio question, please press star 1. I do have a question from the line of Maria Rivera. Please proceed.
Yeah, this is John Hain again at Florida Presbyterian Homes. If your purpose, if your goal is to award high-quality payers a higher reimbursement, high-quality providers a higher reimbursement, why are you starting at the 30th percentile?
Elaborate, if you don't mind, as opposed to what? What would you suggest?
Am I still on the line?
Yes. Are you
still? Hello? I would say no less than the 50th percentile.
Okay.
If you're truly a high-quality provider, you're going to do better than half the people out there. That would be a minimum.
Okay, fair enough.
If I were doing the model, I'd probably want to go to the 70th percentile and really motivate people to get there.
Mention that in order to qualify for any points, you have to be at the median.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, now, fair point, and so noted. To get a point in the quality scoring the way we do it, you either have to be showing a significant improvement year over year, or you, in which case actually you get a small number of points, or you do have to be above the median for any individual point. So there is some challenge to, you have to be doing relatively well, at least in sorry, I'm having microphone trouble. Thank you. So you have to be doing relatively well in at least one scoring component to get any points at all, but your point is valid, and we are trying to, you know, we do want to reward the quality providers, but we do have a variety of goals of the payment method and stakeholder points of view that we're trying to balance as well. But you know, we certainly accept your input.
Mel, and just to go back, if you go back to slides 7 and 8, you can see the criteria for each of the different components of the quality measures. And to even receive a 1 point for any of these, you have to be above the 50th percentile. And so the standards are pretty high to begin with. And we've actually received some comments where people were thinking that the 30th percentile was too high because of the minimum standards to ever get a point for any of these. So we're just trying to find that middle ground and an appropriate level so we can make sure that we're creating the right incentives as opposed to not allowing anybody the opportunity to succeed under this model.
All right, any other questions on the line?
Next question comes from the line of Doug Burr with Healthcare Navigator. Please proceed.
Good afternoon, everyone. How are you?
Good.
With respect to the fair rental changes on slide 14, the total square footage at 1.6 times the patient square footage, I'm assuming that's just a placeholder until you actually get submission of data from the providers who haven't yet submitted the data. And I'm also assuming that providers who have submitted data are not going to have to resubmit data.
Our thinking was actually that we would just move forward with this 60% add-on and not rely so much on what's reported in a separate survey. And part of that is the administrative simplicity of this, in that we already have patient care square footage available in the cost reports. And this is also a little bit in response to the question about equity of providers that have home office square footage and those that have administrative square footage in their facilities, and how do we count all of those things and making sure that we're being fair in that regard. And our thinking was that if we came up with a standard amount or a standard percentage that you could add on to the patient care square footage, that you would eliminate any inequities that might be related to administrative or non-patient care square feet. whether it's home office or in a facility that doesn't have a home office. So our thinking is that we would move forward with this approach as a standard approach.
Do you have the breakdown of what this looks like in terms of ranges of high and low for square footage per bed that's going to fall in the patient care and non-patient care components?
Well, of course we have that in the data that we've received through the surveys. We don't have that available for the presentation today, but we do have that data, yes.
Well, no, but I was wondering if you could actually calculate that using this methodology and publish that on the website so we could take a look at that.
Okay, specifically calculate.
I'm just concerned about it for a whole different reason, because the FRVS calculates square footage assumingly based upon total square footage.
That's correct. Yeah, and what we're doing is we're basically trying to standardize that to some extent. At least for. Hello? At least for about 35% of the total square footage, we're trying to standardize that. And this is really, it's in response to questions or comments we'd received about the home office side of things, where there was some concern that you had providers that had home office square footage that wasn't getting counted. And
that's really in response to a lot of my questions on the home office stuff, and I'm concerned that this approach might do more harm than good, and I'd withdraw my home office comments over concerns about this.
Yeah, sure, and I appreciate that. But specifically, what would you like us? We can create some statistics if you'd like to see them. Is there some? What would you like to see? Because we'd be happy to get that out there for folks.
Yeah, the ranges of square feet per bed for each of these components, the patient care and non-patient care. You know, what does this look like?
Sure. Yeah, we can show that. Just keep in mind, we can only show that for the facilities that we have survey data for. But it would be most of the
right,
providers.
I understand.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, we can do that. Absolutely.
The other thing was, I did have a couple of questions going back to the quality section. Where'd they go? There they are. We had talked quite a bit on earlier calls about the potential of adding a retention measure down the line, and you know, once PBJ data became available, and I'm assuming you would put that into a structure measure component. I'd like to propose that the report comment on that and suggest that we would propose to add that retention measure, and the way we would propose to do it is through a reallocation of the maximum points that are already in that structure measure. And the reason I would propose that is because I hear the concern of some of the other stakeholders about wanting to make sure that staffing is adequately represented. So I wouldn't want to take any points away from staffing. So keeping the number of points in that structure measure component and adding a retention measure, which is another form of staffing measure. So perhaps, you know, reducing the social work activity maximum to 2 points and the CMS 5-star rating to a maximum of 3 points would give you the ability to keep the total at 40 and still add a retention measure.
Hi, Doug. This is Jay. So it is our intention, and in one of the previous presentations we had referenced that staffing retention is one that we're really interested in seeing included in a model whenever that data becomes available. And right now the way we kind of envision it is either being a new measure or a replacement for one of the structural measures. And, again, it will be up to the agency and or the legislature going forward to decide how new measures will be included. But we feel that that and several other of the upcoming measures from CMS would be valid replacements for some of those that we are currently proposing.
Yeah, and if it was a replacement for the for one of the structure measures, that would be fine. But if it was going to be an additional new measure, a part of my rationale for reducing the overall five-star rating measure is the same argument that I've given before. That's a three-year trailing measure. So it kind of seems a little bit unfair that, you know, a provider 3 years later is still being held accountable for something that may have been fixed 3 years ago. And it may even be a new provider that's now still being held accountable for a prior operator survey from 2 or 3 years ago. So giving it a little bit less overall total weight might have some justification.
So noted. Thanks.
And the final comment I had relative back to the FRS component, you know, it's got the floor in there of 100 square feet. I'm not an expert on the life safety code in the state of Florida, but I think that the minimum for a semi-private room alone is 120 or 125 square feet of free and clear space just in that room alone, let alone the hallway to get to that room or any other space within the facility. So I think 100 square feet per bed doesn't even meet the, and it's 120 square feet of free space per bed. So I'm not even sure that meets the minimum building code, life safety code requirements. I would think we'd have to have at least a minimum that would meet those requirements.
Yeah, okay, we can check into that. In honesty, we put it in the 100 square feet minimum as a, really as a way to catch facilities where we think they have not reported correctly what their square footage are. We don't really think that any facility actually has space that low, but there were, in fact, in our data, a very small number, maybe three or four facilities that literally had below 100 square feet for per bed. So really, it was kind of a catch-all for what we think are reporting errors.
And just to let you know, I've tasked one of our architects that has been working on one of our new certificate of need facilities to use the existing building codes and requirements of participation and everything. And I said, design a 100-bed building as small as you possibly can and still be in compliance, because I want to know how small you could potentially get a building. He said he would do it, but he wouldn't be able to have it until just before Thanksgiving. So my intention is to actually provide that information to you, but I won't have it for you until just before Thanksgiving.
Okay. You know, in general, we debated having no minimum at all, with the thought that if a facility doesn't get their reporting correctly, that's their issue. But we thought that was a little cruel, so we put in some sort of minimum. But in general, we expect people to report the square footage of their facilities accurately.
There are no remaining questions.
Okay, thank you. We got an additional question in the room here.
Thank you very much. One comment and then one question, if I could. The 30th person, the one significant change that you all have made that actually made more of an impact on the equity distribution of losses and gains is the 30th percentile on the quality matrix. So when I see potentially dropping down from that or going somewhere in between, it causes me some concern. At the same time, let me also say that for the sake of equity, there are some facilities who are trying to earn some improvement points that have points here and there, and it's probably not appropriate to leave them also out. It just seems to me if somehow you could exempt those points, only those points that are earned because of an improvement, that would give them an opportunity to get some of the quality dollars in recognition of their improvement. That's basically all I would like to know. So the question is whether or not you guys actually consider that, and would you consider it in the future?
Yeah, that's a good comment and a good suggestion, and we can take that under consideration. Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, so it looks like we can probably move on to the next section here, section 4.
Looks like it's working. We have very temperamental microphones in here. So now we're going to talk about a potential transition period for a little bit. Our intent in the report is to recommend or suggest a couple of different ways that a transition period could be done, but not offer a strong suggestion as to what we think is the best answer. Part of the reason for that is that under the hospital changes that occurred with the DRG for hospital inpatient, the legislature ended up deciding to come up with new money for 1 year, and they used that as their transition period. Well, again, we're under strict instruction to stay budget neutral, so we don't feel we can really suggest that, although it might not be a bad idea. And so, again, we tend to be we're planning just to
see. All right, trying with a new microphone. We plan to offer some suggestions of what could be done, and I think in the report even run some numbers just to make it as tangible as possible, and then leave that decision in terms of transition period up to the legislature. So this will be kind of a quick conversation, but anyway, the some simple ideas that exist that we could consider. The first one here, provide new state funds for all or some portion of the projected losses. That's consistent with what was done under the DRG payment method that went in about 3 years ago. In that particular case, the legislature came up with some money. The total computable with the federal funds was $65 million, which was less than half of the total losses. So they did not help every facility out 100% in projected losses, but there was some money that did help facilities out. Another option that's very commonly used in payment transformation for transition periods is limiting increases and decreases to some percentage, and generally we can do that in a budget-neutral manner and be able to then, again, it's a disappointment to have to limit an increase, but with the benefit of being able to limit the decreases to individual facilities. And just as an example, 5% might be a number that would be within reason. We have at least talked about the idea that could we consider even getting fancier and adjusting the amount, the cap, or that percentage point based on quality. But in honesty, I think that'll get a little complicated. We'll see if we even attempt to write that into the report. And of course, just simply to be complete, another option would be to have no transition period at all. All right, so now really we'll be done pretty soon, and we'll be able to open it up for comments. But we wanted to go through and kind of summarize where we are at this point. As Tom said, we're getting pretty close to writing the report. And so we wanted to summarize what we've talked about over the last 3 or 4 months and where we're leaning on all these things in terms of recommendations to go to the legislature. So first of all, we're saying for provider types, all nursing homes. We actually are having a little bit of an internal debate about whether or not to carve out the VA facilities. I think there's 6 VA facilities in the state. So that is still a little bit open, but that's the only part of that that's in some debate. Types of recipients, it's going to be adults only, so we have carved out children. We know that actually one facility in particular that carves them out in entirety, but there are 2 other facilities that only carves out a portion of their residents. For peer grouping, and again, peer grouping is how we calculate those medians of cost that we use to calculate the per diems for direct, indirect, and operating. The peer groupings we're using are what we're calling north and south, north being the managed care regions 1 through 9, south being managed care regions 10 and 11, and if my memory serves me, 10 and 11 are Monroe, Miami-Dade, and Broward. Those are the 3 counties in 10 and 11. For percentage of median costs, I didn't want to put numbers in here specifically because it may depend on how the bottom line is we have to stay budget neutral. It may depend on how some of the other parameters play out in the end. But conceptually, we can say we want the percentage of the median to be the highest for direct care, somewhere in the middle for indirect, and then the lowest for operating. In terms of mapping costs to per diems. We had in the last meeting suggested a few changes to the mapping that is used today. At this point, we're planning to go with that mapping that was presented in the last public meeting. For floors, we talked about we are planning to recommend a floor of 95% for direct and indirect, and no floor for operating costs. Pass-through payments, we are suggesting including taxes and insurance, which we feel like are relatively out of the control of the facility, including those as pass-through payments in the payment method, and they are pass-through payments today in the current method. We've talked about this a little bit before. You know, the overall direction is clearly to be budget neutral. We have made a decision, and it's been consistent for a couple of months now, that we would try to stay budget neutral for property as a standalone, and then everything that's non-property to be budget neutral, and we're continuing with that thought process. For the nursing home quality assessment payment that folks get, we're planning to keep that exactly as it works today. And at least for now, we are planning to have the ventilator care as a suggested add-on, and so far the only specific service-related add-on. Now we're going to talk about the property component. We're planning to use FRVS, not a surprise to anyone at this point. Again, we're staying budget neutral within property. We have taken taxes and home insurance out of there, again, because they're going to be a pass-through payment, so they're not in the budget for the FRVS piece. We are planning to allow facility renovations to be used to kind of adjust the theoretical age of the facility, which goes into the depreciation calculation. We're planning to use RS means for the square footage, which is probably the most fundamental piece of the FRVS calculation. It's all based off of, or primarily based on, square footage and times a multiplier dollar amount. And as we've mentioned before, we're looking now at this total square footage being calculated as patient square footage, which is a number currently reported in the cost report, times 1.6, and using that as the total square footage per facility. So here are the final parameters we've come up with, and I actually wouldn't necessarily say final. Here's what we've come up with so far for our recommendations. There are a couple of changes in here that are in response to feedback from the industry. So actually, we hope you will like these, but I'd like to go through them. The $200.72 has not changed in the last couple of months. Land allocation being 10% has not changed. Equipment cost per bed is $8,000. I think we have been consistent on that for a couple of months. Depreciation 1.5. The fair rental rate, here's where we have made a change. We went up from 7.5 to 8%. We met with some folks, and they offered a pretty compelling reason as to describing the cost of money used for loans for construction, and that 8% might be a reasonable factor to use to deal with cost of money. So we've gone up a little bit on that. And actually, because of that, we had to adjust a couple other things to stay budget neutral. Minimum occupancy, 90%, has been consistent. We have raised the minimum maximum facility age from 30 years to 40. It's not a significant change, but that helped come up with some money to allow the fair rental rate to be increased. And we reduced the maximum square footage per bed from 600 down to 500. In truth, that only affects about 10 facilities. But that, again, allowed a little bit of money to help fund a higher fair rental rate. And then the last piece is we have most of the time in the past been underspending, if you would, on FRVS, so we've had a budget neutrality factor that's been a little bit over 1. Well, with this new set of parameters, we're actually overspending a little bit. And this is with, again, the home operating property costs being put back into the FRVS budget. We're overspending a little bit, so now we have a budget neutrality factor that's a little bit less than 1 that just brings everyone's rate down a little bit to stay within the total spend prediction. And last one here, this is the quality piece, and really we've gone through this already. In fact, this is a repeat of the slide Jay went through earlier in the presentation. Yes, we want to have a quality incentive program. We're going to fund it in a way that comes out to 7% of the non-property component spend that occurs today. We're using the 40 points with the scoring system that Jay's gone through in detail, and then we're still a little bit open for debate on where that percentile or threshold to receive money is going to play out. So that's a very quick summary of what the payment method looks like, and is the end of our presentation for today. So we're ready to open it up for public comment.
All right. So I think first, let's just see if there's any questions here related to these last two sections that they just went through, and then we can move into the public comment. So are there any questions on the last couple sections? I see a few hands here for questions.
Hi, Kathy Urbanovic with Clifton Larson Allen. On the FRVS, is it patient care square footage or non-patient care? I'm thinking it said non-patient care, but I wasn't sure.
It is non-patient. It is total square footage, so both patient care and non-patient care factor in.
All right, scoot back a couple slides. Okay, up one, forward one. Whoops.
Sorry, I went backwards. I may have... Here we go.
All right, so the non-patient square footage times 1.6.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's a bit of a typo. The times 1.6 equals total square footage for the facility, and we will use total square footage for the FRVS calculation.
Okay.
So it's a good catch. Thank you.
This is John McManus with Summit. I was wondering what you were planning to do with a new facility as far as this plan goes. How do you address their reimbursement?
Yeah, I would say that we haven't fully addressed that issue yet, but we do intend to cover that in our report, and we can share that approach. But we would have to come up with some kind of a way to rely on the rates that we're paying to other providers until they have information that we can use for the quality component and for the FRVS component. But other than that, the rates should be essentially the same.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions here? Here we go.
Good afternoon. Bob Estalas with Florida Healthcare Association. A little bit about the your transition section, Mal. You know, it is a real concern about trying to cushion providers and the impact for those providers who are going to have a major impact. And I know that you talked about you're going to give the legislature options from no transition on up. But are you also going to put in their comments or recommendations as far as the transition goes? Or are you going to discuss, even though it's outside your mandate, using new money?
Our plan as of now is to list using new money as one of the options, and it's kind of easy, in all honesty, for us to suggest that as an option simply because that's the way it was done 3 years ago for hospitals. Whether or not it'll be done that way this year, I have absolutely no idea. But in general, I think we're simply going to suggest some options and make the point that there are some facilities that are going to see decreases, maybe even highlight some percentages in within the section, and then leave it at that.
Although I will add, too, that we will be showing provider-by-provider details, so it'll be quite obvious that you're going to have providers that are going to be that are going to get less under this new method, and some that are going to get more, and it'll be quite easy to quantify what the dollar amount is of those that are coming out less than what they were before. So that detail is going to be in the report.
Thank you. I know you all have, and I appreciate all the work you guys have done on these models, by the way. you're going to use the current data that's in place to present to the legislature, and maybe Tom, I don't know, maybe you can speak to this. Is there a plan to incorporate the next round of cost report information into the actual beginning PPS model?
Yeah, so the actual model, I guess it's going to depend on when we get all that cost report information in and the timing of legislative session. So I'm not sure we're going to have all that detail in time to be incorporated into rates that I guess could be effective as early as October of 17 under the new method. So we would have to go with what we have, and that would be, I guess, in terms of cost reports, what we probably currently have now.
Okay. And then just to follow up on that, we have several providers that are currently going through a change of ownership, and I know we've talked about how new providers will just assume the old provider rate. We may have to revisit that because, you know, new owners and new operators come into the facilities usually because they're not being managed properly or their quality and or their quality is poor. And so I think to have a new operator try to work under the onus of the previous provider that may have run a facility into the ground puts a lot of pressure on them to try to bring up the status of that facility with very limited funds if they're going to be limited to no quality component for a facility they take over or one that's not performing right. So just something maybe to consider, to reconsider that rule of a new provider as far as the change of ownership is concerned, takes over that old provider rate and then has to start from there. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think it's what we're really talking about is where the differences in the rates are going to be primarily going to be in the FRVS side, which our assumption is probably wouldn't change significantly even under new ownership. And it's just, and that's a small piece. That's, you know, the total capital piece is 5 to 6% of the total rate to begin with. And then it really kind of comes down to the quality piece. And I think the quality piece we're going to be updating, I'm pretty sure our recommendation is going to be that has to be updated at least once a year. And so there will be an opportunity to improve that. And then finally, our expectation is that in a change of ownership, any potential buyer is going to be examining the market and the potential Medicaid rates. And it's my understanding that the Medicaid rates are one of the first things they might look at when deciding whether or not they're going to buy a facility. And our expectation is that they've figured out that they can operate within the budget that we're working with here.
Any other questions here in the audience before we move to the phone? No? Okay. Operator, you mind checking and see if there's any questions at this point?
Absolutely. We have one question in queue from Martin Casper with Morse Life. Please proceed.
The 30th percentile on the quality matrix. I think that the 30th percentile is a reasonable compromise, and I would very strongly be opposed to allowing quality points from 1 to that 30th percentile. It's kind of like the equivalent of spelling your name correctly on your SATs and getting credit for it. I think 30% is pretty reasonable. The other comment that I'd like to make would be with regard to the ventilator differential. A comment was made earlier that if the industry itself does not strongly feel that the ventilator differential is necessary, then we'd be inclined not to push it so hard. I think that there are only about 20 facilities out of the 670-some-odd facilities in the state of Florida that operate a true ventilator program. So access to our Florida elderly, as well as all patients to ventilator dependent, is extremely limited. In 2003, a report was given to the Florida Health Department justifying the need for a differential, and a differential did in fact exist in the 1980s. $200 is a vent differential is reasonable and will provide access. I think from a health policy point of view, we all are talking about the need to minimize higher cost referrals to LTACs, not only for ventilator patients, but for other patients who may be more appropriately placed in skilled nursing facilities providing equal care. If you put that $200 a day vent differential in place, there will be sufficient nursing homes added to those 20 that currently existed. Incidentally, I've been responsible for about 10 of them developed right now in the state of Florida, and that will give a very cost-effective alternative to the LTACs, not to mention the fact that we in our skilled nursing facility industry have a whole extra requirement of psychosocial components that are imperative to provide to ventilator-dependent patients who are the most needy and not only emotionally but physically of patients. So I really would urge you not to, you know, okay, we've got 650 facilities that don't operate vent units. I can live without the differential. I urge you to be very careful before considering removal of that $200 differential. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for those comments. Operator, are there any questions on the phone, and then we'll go to public comment period?
Yes, we have a question from Doug Burr with Healthcare Navigator. Please proceed.
Yes, with respect to the transition period, I'd like to make a request for consideration of the approach that was taken by Medicare when they went to their price-based prospective payment system, where they used a blend of the provider's existing rate at the time under the prior payment system and the rate that was set calculated under the new system and transitioned that in over a period of years. And I know that the agency's desire is to get full transition done by the time rates are set under the new Medicaid managed care contracts in 2019. So a three-year transition where the 17-18 rates are based, you know, two-thirds on the current methodology as the rates existed or exist in August of 17 and one-third on the new rates. And then the following year, you know, one-third under the old rate and two-thirds under the new rate. And then in September of 2019, 100% on the new rate would seem like a potential reasonable option. And the only way that would potentially cost money is like Medicare did, if the state would give the option for facilities that would get rate benefit from immediately transitioning 100% to the new payment system, if they were given the option to move directly immediately to that full payment system. And, of course, that would require transitional dollars. But there'd be no downside to the providers that are taking the rate reductions. There'd only be the upside benefit to providers that can't wait to get to the full new payment rate. So that's my suggestion on transition. And to follow up on Marty's comments relative to the vent payment system, it's not that the agency doesn't recognize the need for special population outlier or supplemental payment rates. It's that the challenge is the current system isn't fully funded. So taking money out of the current system to create the new supplemental payments for the specialty populations just creates a further underfunding of the base rates within the current system. We wholly support the creation of pools of money for the special populations, but you can't do it within the pool of funds that's already existed to deliver services for the population that's already there. That's the challenge of trying to implement something in a budget neutral approach. And to his other comment, he's right. Some of those patients are currently being served in LTACs. So from the state's perspective, the way to do this is to actually move some of those funds from one of the other state budget appropriation lines as those patients move from that care setting to the SNF care setting. Thank you.
Thanks,
Doug. The next question comes from the line of Michael Baldwin with Oracle Healthcare Advisors. Please proceed.
Hi, thank you. First, great job on all the work you've done so far in the system. My name is Michael Baldwin at Oracle Healthcare Advisors, and we're a valuation firm in the healthcare real estate space. And my question and comment is basically that with the FRBS calculation, fundamentally, it's not very fair to apply average statewide metrics to the individual facility level. So I wanted to ask you all on the call here, have you considered other approaches, for example, actually, you know, individual facility valuations?
We have. We considered individual facility valuations, but I think from the state's perspective, that's probably administratively something they don't want to take on. And one of the charges we have is to make this as administratively simple as we can. And we have to balance that with the notion that the capital or the property component of the rate is really a pretty small piece, too. We're really trying to focus most of our efforts on trying to improve or trying to address the rest of the components. We're trying to find a way to do the valuation through the FRVS that is that can be applied year to year relatively simply and not require a whole lot of additional reporting from the providers that already occurs. And I think the approach that we're suggesting today, where we start with the patient care piece, which is already reported in their Medicaid cost reports, the approach we've described is a pretty simple way to do it, understanding that there's going to be some variation in the actual costs, but that variation really exists to a significant extent in all the rate components, not just the property component.
So, you know, there are about 10 other states out there who are doing the same FRVS calculation, but they are doing valuations at the facility level. And I bring this up because looking at your methodology, what you're essentially doing is you're applying average statewide metrics at the individual facility level, and that can have unintended consequences and create unintended incentives relative to, you know, what's being reported on cost reports. Even, you know, if someone's building a new facility, what do they want to do? There was one gentleman who commented of, you know, asking his architect, how small can I make a facility? And the implication there that a lot of people are probably thinking of is, look, if it's 1.6 times patient areas, what you're really incentivizing is a little common area. And you say, look, I can build a facility that's relatively small, but get reimbursed at the statewide average multiple of 1.6. And that's not what patients and residents and family members of residents want. You know, we want a system that's fair. And so, you know, this is basically a zero-sum game with it being budget neutral. And so you're I think, artificially creating winners and losers here by not going the route that a lot of other states have done. You know, for example, the 1.6 multiplier, for example, 10% of cost as land value, that's not representative of actual values at the individual facility level. And you're right that it's not a huge number in the whole grand scheme of things. But when you're designing this system, if you're designing it in a way that creates certain incentives, you know, that can be a problem. So, for example, we're doing valuations for a large state right now with hundreds of nursing homes, and not as many as Florida, but still, maybe two-thirds of that number. I think they've got about 400 nursing homes in the state. And facilities have been reporting historically, you know, square footage numbers, including the attached ALF, or including space that's not even being used anymore, beds out of service and a vacant wing, and they're reporting it. And so that's not going to get picked up in your numbers, and that creates some ill incentives. So, you know, states like Colorado, Wisconsin, Tennessee, Minnesota, Kentucky, there's probably 10 or 15 states even that have adopted the system. They do it in a way that's not administratively complex. Also allows for a way when a facility does do a renovation for there to be some independent verification of what actually happened. You're not going to pick up in this manner when facilities close wings or space that's not being used. And so ultimately you're kind of adding noise to the system for one of the value components where it's really not necessary. And so by doing the FRVS calculation, you can still run your calculation, but basically what I would do, I would recommend that you guys consider an alternative approach that many of the other states have implemented, not, you know, administrative burden, you know, not intense there, because it all gets outsourced anyway, like you guys are having RS means just calculated, or I don't know what you're doing with that exactly, but, you know, I personally strongly consider this alternative route because it's actually fair. You know, it's an established methodology used by a bunch of states. It removes reporting bias. It removes, you know, design bias. And it'd be a nice piece of the system that all providers can get behind and agree that it's an improvement over what's proposed so far, which is, you know, one size fits all and creating bad incentives.
Okay, thank you.
The next question comes from the line of James Richardson with Gulf Coast Healthcare. Please proceed.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. I'd like to concur with the gentleman that just spoke and kind of piggybacking on that, as we look at the value or percentage that we're placing inside of the quality component, and I know you're working under budget neutrality within different segments of this proposal, but if you were to look at the budget neutrality as a whole and then allowing that quality component to work a percentage down towards a lesser percentage and then tie that back into the FRVS component so that we can promote the, I guess you'd say, quality of life, which is the environment in which our residents live. So I believe that there are some ways that we can meet both needs in meeting the quality goal and also the quality of life goal. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any other questions?
No remaining questions.
All right, thanks. So with that, we can turn over to do public comment now. So the first on the list I'd like to speak. I'll go down the list here. If there are others that like to speak, feel free to do it. We'll start in the room first. And first up is Erwin.
Thank you very much. Assuming that this is probably the last meeting, my name is Erwin Bodo, Leading Cage, Florida. You guys know it by heart by now. But assuming that this is the last meeting, first I want to thank you all for the job that you have done. I think you tried to make the best lemonade given what you've been given. And I know it's difficult. I certainly have tried to do all kinds of modeling myself. It's not easy to come up with something that's going to please everybody, and ultimately you'll end up with something that pleases nobody. But still, it's the best that you can do, and given the circumstances, we understand that. I'd like to encourage you on a couple of things. One is, because of the unacceptably large losses and gains, we really would like to suggest that the 5% limit for losses and gains be implemented, along with some kind of a phasing like Mr. Burr mentioned earlier. We are not against the basic concept of having additional money for a number of things, including if the state wants to get additional dollars for paying the ones who go up, or if they want to get more dollars for helping all the ones who are going down, some transitional dollars, we certainly would be supporting of that. We're not against the ventilator care issue per se, except for one thing. It's $8.2 million right now, but it could be $20 million next year and could be $40 million the year after. All by itself is good, and we're supporting the effort of having ventilator care paid for, and it's probably the right environment to do that at a least costly way. At the same time, if it's going to eat into the budget for all the other nursing homes without additional appropriations, that it potentially could be some kind of a problem. As it is, I'm seeing numbers in the 15 to 20% range for both up and down changes. That scares me. That really does scare me, that what we have here is essentially a way of creating turmoil in an industry that's been fairly steady, fairly equilibrium for the last 25, 30 years or so. We have had changes. We have had budget cuts. We have had all kinds of other things that the industry was able to deal with. Those type of cuts that we see, I think they're going to have a very difficult time to deal with, and more than likely they're going to end up, the losers end up taking some of their existing staff and having to reduce their staffing one way or another, perhaps benefits, perhaps pay, whatever. Some will be able to deal with the problems without any issues just because they are in the situation. Several times you all have mentioned that there is the example of the hospital inpatient situation where they also went through a change. I'd like to remind you that there is a tremendous difference between that industry and the nursing homes. Very few hospitals run 95% Medicaid facilities. That just doesn't happen in the industry. It does happen in a nursing home. It represents an entirely different type of environment, an entirely different type of care. To the last comments that were just offered a minute ago, I have done some literature search in the last few months, and I have yet to find a single article anywhere that even remotely mentions facility or somehow enhancing quality of life. So we're not opposed to having additional dollars for whatever purpose the state would like to do, but we are totally opposed to taking any of the quality care dollars and use it for property. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Owen, for those comments. Next, Kathy, did you want to speak? No? Okay. We got Martin.
Thank you. Loud enough? I've never been accused of not being loud enough. Mr. Wallace, members of the Navigant Consultant Group, colleagues in the room, Secretary Dudek. My name is Martin Goetz. I'm the administrator and chief executive officer at River Garden Hebrew Home, Jacksonville. I've been at River Garden for the last 38 years. My River Garden tenure precedes the current reimbursement plan. Over these many years, I've had ample opportunity to observe how the current plan, generally referred to as the Gainesville plan, has positively impacted the approximately 650 nursing homes in Florida. The purpose of the Navigant study was not to alter existing public policy, but rather to make it possible for a prospective payment system to relieve ACA from having to make retroactive audit adjustments. The models, all of them, being presented by Navigant accomplish that goal, but in the process have clearly been designed to substitute profits over people. Floridians and the state legislature will not tolerate a return to the old days. The oldest and frailest among our people simply deserve better. The current work performed by Navigant is unacceptable in its present form. While achieving ACA's goal of eliminating retroactive rate adjustments, the Navigant model subverts long-standing public policy, which is designed to encourage providers to provide care. Navigant's prospective reimbursement system plan shifts approximately $100 million from some providers to others. The overwhelming majority of this money is being moved from providers who use the money to fund patient care to those who have no obligation to earmark the funds for patient care, effectively creating profits over people. The current reimbursement plan says to any willing nursing home provider, if you spend funds in furtherance of patient care, then the state Medicaid program will reimburse for those care-related costs up to reasonable limits and caps. Public policy has been well served, and Florida's nursing homes have been appropriately conditioned to understand that our legislature encourages the proper and appropriate funding of costs associated with direct patient care. In our own case, River Garden Hebrew Home is now in its 70th year and has a history that precedes Medicare and Medicaid and the business of elder care. Our agency is sponsored by the organized Jacksonville Jewish community and serves the entire community on a non-sectarian basis. With 180 beds, our nursing home annually admits approximately 500 individuals each year to one of its residential care programs. Last year, we provided over 62,000 days of care, of which over 50% was funded through Medicaid. The nursing home also operates an active adult day program and a licensed home health agency, and we have an enviable record of helping elderly forestall premature admission to the nursing home. Our annual Medicaid shortfall currently is more than $1 million annually, and it's covered through community philanthropy and charity. We're able to gain that level of charitable support because at River Garden, everybody is a somebody, and we are well identified as an outstanding care community. But the community simply doesn't have the ability to subsidize another $500,000 annually in a new shortfall that results from Navigant's proposal. No one has said that we've spent funds unwisely, and no one has said that we're providing luxury care. Our care community remains focused on its mission, vision, and values. Over the years, many have pointed to River Garden as a model of what a good nursing home should be, and many point to our 8 Gold Seal Awards for excellence in long-term care as a validation that this work can be done well. And so what public policy purpose is served by pulling the rug out from under us and other providers like us? Navigant can do better. Navigant is capable of devising a system that allows ACA to achieve its goal of eliminating retroactive rate adjustments. It's possible to achieve this goal without compromising the overwhelming public policy imperative of focusing on the constant improvement of care and service to the most vulnerable and frail. This is simply one of the most ill-considered attempts at policy reform. There are some who are clearly looking forward to the unanticipated and unearned windfall profits at the cost of those who have actually been spending on care and in the process achieving exemplary results. The cost is also a subversion of long-standing public policy that has helped create a long care system of quality. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Don Wilson.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Don Wilson. I'm the executive director at Westminster Oaks Active Living Community here in Tallahassee, and I appreciate the opportunity to make some comments and, more importantly, some concerns. Westminster Oaks and Westminster Communities of Florida, which is our parent organization, are not-for-profit, faith-based senior living organizations committed to providing services to seniors throughout Florida. We are dedicated to provide high-quality care to all of our communities as reflected by our CMS 5-star ratings as well as our internal quality of life surveys. To give you a little more information specifically on both organizations, Westminster Communities of Florida is the state's largest not-for-profit senior living organization. We serve 7,000 residents per day and have 2,500 employees with 751 nursing beds. Westminster Oaks, right here in Tallahassee, serves more than 650 residents a day, which includes a 120-bed nursing home. The changes in the Medicare reimbursement system would have significant impact on both our parent organization, Westminster Care of Florida, and Westminster Oaks. Westminster Care of Florida is looking at potentially $3 million annual reduction in Medicaid reimbursement. Westminster Oaks, here in Tallahassee, is looking at potentially $161,000 in reduced income under these changes. Now, that affects not only the quality of care, the quality of life for the residents, but also the quality of life for our employees. So to look at how to overcome this lost revenue, we have to take multitude of changes, or look at multitude of changes. One of the changes might be to increase the rate charged per day for private pay residents. So to put the burden on private pay residents to offset the revenue from Medicaid residents. Another change might be a way to reduce costs in non-direct care because we have staffing minimums, but we might have to look at cutting back on the activity schedule, cut back on the activity staff, which would affect the quality of life of the residents in our health center. We might have to look at reducing the amount of money we spend on food, maybe reduce staff in other areas, maybe in housekeeping, in maintenance. So the quality of life could be drastically affected to the residents. We might have to look at employee issues. We might have to reduce staff, not be able to have as competitive wages, look at reducing health insurance benefit or the quality of life insurance to our employees. So there's a multitude of changes that we would have to look at to cover this loss in Medicaid reimbursement. In addition, the overall long term, the proposed reductions in Medicaid reimbursement could have a strong potential for being a drag on the greater economy and the communities that we all serve throughout the state of Florida. Thank you for the opportunity to give you some comments and, more important, concerns.
Thank you for those comments. Deborah Franklin, any comments?
Hi, I'm Deborah Franklin. I am representing Florida Healthcare Association. I'm the chair of the Prospective Payment Task Force. Thank you, Navigant, and Mr. Wallace, all the work that you've done on this. I know it's a history setting for the state of Florida. We've been living, as this gentleman said, under our plan since the Gainesville plan, and caregivers are caregivers, and we're going to make it work to continue to give care, but we don't want to see any unintended consequences for the seniors in Florida. We would like to share with you two new recommendations today, as well as restate some ideas previously shared. Florida Healthcare does not think that the 10.5 overall quality threshold should be used. If the intention of this new payment plan is to incentivize providers to raise their quality levels, this threshold limiting almost a third of the current providers with the lowest quality scores eliminates the chance for those providers to receive the necessary funds to improve those quality scores. Florida Healthcare Association believes that all providers should be rewarded for the quality care they are providing and have incentive for continued improvements, even if the improvements are made gradually each year. In addition, Florida Healthcare Association believes the percentile methodology that is being used to score individual quality measured should be replaced by a threshold methodology that rewards all providers who achieve preset levels at each measure. This would allow the state to adequately reward providers when they are successful in improving outcomes in each measure. Florida Healthcare Association cannot support a model that contains a total quality pool of funds at 7%. This money comes at the expense of rates that are currently underfunded, as you've heard in this room already today, by over $100 million annually. To remove more money from the base rates increases the amount of unfunded costs passed on to providers, or as this gentleman said, private pay. Florida Healthcare Association can support a quality pool of 2% in the first year, with the potential to increase in future years as additional funds are added. Florida Healthcare Association also cannot support a model that does not appropriately fund fair rental value. Fair rental value represents quality of life for these people living in the skilled nursing facilities. Reducing
The quality pool frees up much-needed funds to ensure providers are given the financial incentive to repair and replace buildings that are, on average, 35 years old. We must upgrade technologies and modernize our centers to meet the expectation of the changing demographics of our customers, aka baby boomers. We believe the Navigant method of treating FRV as a separate budget-neutral component is flawed and would do nothing to incentivize upgrades and renovations. Lastly, in the model shared at the October 26 public meeting, Navigant revealed plans to create a ventilator supplement payment of $200 per day. Florida Healthcare agrees there are currently hard. This is currently a hard-to-serve population, such as ventilator patients who have access problems. However, the current system does not properly reimburse for these populations. So, in a budget neutral, to take those funds for a new population would create even more unintended consequences. Doing so in the new PPS in a budget neutral manner would remove funds from currently underfunded Medicaid rates. We request Navigant recommend additional legislative appropriated funds for these populations if the state wants to resolve the access problem and not use current funds to do so. In closing, we'd like to thank you again for the opportunity to present today and to be at the table and give input throughout this process.
Thank you. Thanks for those comments. Next, we have on here Steve. You want to make comments? No? Okay. Are there any other ones in the public, in the room here for the public meeting that want to make comments? A couple over here. Okay.
Good afternoon. My name is Kevin Smoggy, and I serve as the Director of Health Services for the Alliance Community. We are a faith-based CCRC in DeLand, Florida, Volusia County. I will never be accused of being as eloquent as my good friend Marty, whom I've known for a long time, and my good friend Don Wilson, whom I've known for a long time. But I think I'm probably going to say the same thing maybe in a more down-to-earth my way, I guess. I can just simply say this. I know Marty's property, and I know Mr. Wilson's property. And facilities like those, with Marty's 8 consecutive Gold Seal awards, to be having to figure out where to find $500,000, there's something wrong with the model. That just does not make any sense at all. I don't know what is wrong. I'm not a mathematician, but it's wrong. I would like to say this. I have heard said a couple of times today that we want to reward high-quality performers. I'm okay with that. But that also means that we need to punish, you may not like the word, that's the word, punish lower-performing facilities or take money away if that's a better word for you. However, that assumes that lower-performing facilities are doing so by choice and could do better if they want to. Now, this might sound strange, so please listen to me and hear me out. While that may be true in some cases, it is certainly not true in all cases. Not at all. Some facilities, many facilities, do not perform as well as others simply because they do not have the resources to hire a whole bunch of RNs, if we are fortunate even to find them. They may not even have the resources to develop extensive programs that might drive those numbers even higher. They may not have the resources to run higher percentages, ratios, PPD for your CNAs. My facility is such a facility. We're a smaller CCRC. When we write a budget, we are very happy if we come up with a couple of extra dollars extra when we're done with the year. We put everything we have into the facility. We're a not-for-profit, faith-based organization, been in DeLand for over 60 years, and I think we do a pretty good job. The director of nursing is excellent. My staff is excellent. But to take money away from my facility and other small facilities like mine will not solve this problem. In fact, it will simply drive the quality measures further down. As Don was saying, Mr. Wilson, I would have to find ways to find the money. The only way I could do that would be to cut programs, to cut staff, and those are the staff and the programs that I need to raise the quality. It will be a downward spiral. If I'm cutting staff that helps me assure quality, then my quality is going to go down and go down and go down until eventually I'm out of business. That is not acceptable. So I strongly encourage the group to think of something a little bit different. Again, a building like Marty's with its subsequent Gold Seal awards should never be trying to figure out how to find $500,000. There's something wrong with the methodology. I would also like to speak to the idea of the two different regions. I know that was not discussed in great detail today. It's been discussed in the past. And frankly, I don't understand why we have to just have two regions. Again, I'm not a mathematician, and I don't remember really hearing a good reason other than it's difficult to do. I don't care if it's difficult to do. It's the right thing to do to have sufficient regions that reflect the diversity of this great state of Florida. It's a big state. 657 facilities from all over the area with all different demographics. And anybody that thinks that a state of Florida as vast and as diverse as this state can be broken down into two regions doesn't understand the state of Florida. There is much more to that than this. The last thing I want to speak about is this transition period that we've talked about today. I strongly encourage you to take a position. You must go to the governor. You must go to the legislature with a position. To not have a position simply lets them decide what they want to do, and they don't necessarily have the background, the information, the resources, the knowledge, education that you do to make a good decision. Let me make it as simple as I can. If this goes through the way it is, and I have to find $350,000, I know what I'll do. I'll have no choice but to cut staff, as I've already said. I'll have no choice but to lower, perhaps downsize my building. Instead of being a 130-bed facility, I might have to reduce it to an 80-bed facility. In other words, take less Medicaid. Some facilities, small 60-bed, might very well close. You need to understand that this transition is critical. I cannot absorb a $300,000 hit in 1 year. Nobody can. So please take a position. If this must go through, then give us the time to adjust our budgets over a period of time so we can at least continue to provide the quality of care that we are providing. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dale, you were at SEIU 1199. We have a number of comments, most of which I'll hold for written comments, get to you early next week. I do want to thank you for the work you've done, but I wanted to say again, although this decision is clearly not gone in the way we would prefer it to, that we still think it's inappropriate to treat labor costs, staffing costs, on a price basis rather than a cost basis. The ugly truth is that it's the poverty wages of nursing home workers that subsidize the nursing home industry in this state. At least the current system allows providers who are willing to do so to spend the money on their staff and be reimbursed based on their cost. By moving away from cost to price, we're taking away that potential. Others have spoken both in this meeting and in previous meetings far more eloquently than I about the effect this is going to have on high-cost providers, high-reimbursement providers, high-quality providers, and the difficult choices they're going to have to make. Even if we were deciding that there is a greater good to flatten out the reimbursement rates and to take away from those who are spending more and give to those who are spending less, it surely can't be right to give that money to the low-cost providers without any obligation for them to spend that money to improve quality conditions either for their residents or for the caregivers that serve those residents. And yet that's the system that we'll be creating here. There will be some providers, I'm sure, who will welcome the extra revenue and who will use it to improve care. But I think we can't be blind to the fact that there is a segment of the industry that has deliberately chosen to keep its costs low. And that's its business model. And by giving them 10, 15, 20% more reimbursement without any accountability, without any requirement, there's no reason why they would change their behavior. They'll simply pocket the unearned windfall, and the public policy of quality care for residents will be undermined. So we are not opposed to PPS as a form of payment, but we believe that the direction in which this is going sets dangerous precedents and will have unintended and negative consequences. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Are there anyone else in the audience here that would like to make a public comment? All right, seeing none, operator, let's go to the phone and see if there's anyone online here that would like to make some or any public comment.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to make a comment, please press star one. The first comment comes from the line of Doug Burr with Healthcare Navigator. Please proceed.
I'd just like to take a moment to thank the agency and thank Navigant for making this process so open and transparent and for soliciting everybody's input and taking the time to really listen to all of the concerns that we've had through the process and to making modifications to the different proposals throughout the process. I'm sure you're going to be getting a whole series of recommendations over the next day or two on additional ways to modify and change the model. But I just really appreciate the way the process has gone to date. I've been involved in similar processes that have taken over 2 years in probably at least a half a dozen other states. And this has been really a well-run and well-thought-out process. So I just wanted to put that comment out there.
Yep. Thanks, Doug.
The next comment comes from the line of Debbie Patterson. Please proceed.
Hi, I'm also with Westminster Communities of Florida, and my community is Westminster Manor in Bradenton. And we're finding that the current proposed models are unnecessarily complex, and they don't achieve Navigant's own stated goals for the study. It's supposed to be a system that promotes quality, ensures access, and reflects simplicity and equity. Rather, that it's creating a single, simple price that would be paid to nursing homes through Medicaid, the proposed models will result in hundreds of different prices, thereby failing to simplify the system. Currently, the proposed models threaten the quality of care being delivered by Florida's highest quality nursing homes. None of the models can be expected to lead to higher quality care, since most models simply shift dollars from high quality nursing homes to low quality nursing homes without any mechanism for ensuring that quality improves. And as a result, quality will be threatened among the best providers, and it's unlikely to improve among the worst, and those in the middle would be dragged down by even minimal funding losses. Navigant's goal is to produce an equitable reimbursement system. However, all of the models currently proposed result in unreasonable losses for some nursing homes and unreasonable windfalls for others. Right now, the Manor alone would be looking at a loss of $367,000, and we only have 59 skilled nursing beds on our campus. ACA and the legislature should push for a plan that emphasizes and rewards high-quality care and that provides the necessary funding to ensure that providers can continue to deliver high-quality care. It costs money, and that's one reason the highest-quality nursing homes are often also the higher-cost nursing homes. Higher staffing levels are a key driver of higher costs, and they are also directly related to higher quality levels. Any changes to the current reimbursement system, as someone else also has mentioned, I believe also should be phased in over a period of years, ideally 3 to 5 years, to give nursing homes sufficient time to adjust to the impact of the changes. Any loss in these Medicaid dollars could impact nursing home operations and, in particular, could impact our ability to deliver quality care. And Medicaid losses could lead to an increased private pay rates and more limited access to care for Medicaid recipients. And I appreciate your time.
Thank you for those comments. Any others?
There are no remaining comments.
Okay. One more time, any other comments or questions anyone has in here in the audience? No? Okay. Well, I'd just like to say thank you all you guys here attending these public meetings. We appreciate all the feedback we've received from here. We've definitely looked at it and took it all to heart here as we move through this process, the stakeholder meetings and the public meetings as well. Again, as I said earlier, if you have written comments or like to submit them to us, please feel free to do so by end of day tomorrow. We'd appreciate that so we can take another look at them and use them as we move forward with finalizing the report. So with that, we'd like to say thank you again, and we will end this meeting.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This concludes the presentation. You may now disconnect.